Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Coming up, what grief reveals among friends and family. Good novel. Hope you'll read it. But first, what if the real national emergency is the warming world, and what if our government treated it as such? That may sound like alarmism to people who see rising temperatures and volatile weather worldwide and believe there's plenty of time to address it. But the science says differently. In a new book, writer David Wallace Wells believes that there's an upside to catastrophizing the growing threat from greenhouse gas emissions, particularly because we're headed quickly for a 1.5 degree Celsius increase by 2040. He writes in the New York Times, "So being alarmed is not a sign of being hysterical. When it comes to climate change, being alarmed is what the facts demand, perhaps the only logical response." We wondered what client scientists think of this, so we're turning to Brenda Eckwurzel. She's Director of Climate Science for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of the Concerned Scientists, and she's with us today from D.C. Brenda, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Great to be here.
First, I want to know if you agree with the scientific conclusions that Mr. Wallace Wells is reaching in the essay. 1.5 degrees Celsius warming within 20 years, maybe 2 degrees Celsius a couple decades after that. Is the science right on that?
That's within the range of confidence that the scientists have for the path if we were to continue the current pace of rise of temperature.
That is something
that is very valid, and that's part of why the international agreement known as the Paris Agreement or the Paris Climate Agreement said we really have to hold temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius and do everything possible to see what we can to keep it below 1.5 degrees Celsius.
I also wondered if you are looking at data and signs around the world and seeing indications that we may be accelerating that degree of warming and that these milestones that we just talked about aren't as far out as we thought.
Well, thanks to the investment in science in the United States, the U.S. Global Change Research Program, 13 federal agencies, Department of Defense, Health and Human Services, NOAA, NASA, and many others have all just recently issued the fourth National Climate Assessment, which essentially says what you just opened up with, that we are on track to we already have a 1 degree Celsius world or 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels, and we're already seeing the devastation that's bringing with more devastating hurricanes that have much more rain and flood potential. The power of these hurricanes are quite intense, and they're showing rapid intensification within 24 hours, which makes it much more difficult for evacuation procedures. We're getting much better at warning people. And right now, for example, pay attention to the rain that's right outside now happening in the Twin Cities and mm-hmm. everything, because this is another cyclogenesis that's happening and dropping rain. And so we are watching the Midwest right now and hoping people stay safe and listen to the weather reports right
now. One of the things that we emphasize often here, because you've just mentioned the weather, is the difference between weather and warming driven by climate change. What I think I heard you again say is look for intensifications of weather patterns, including, as you've just noted, this, you know, day and a half, 18 hours of rain that we're getting. Is that part of how to understand how the weather is being influenced by what's happening with climate change?
You have that exactly right. If we think back to the grade school or in school, we had that little bell curve for giving people grades. And you think of the bell shape, and when you change the average, that's what we're doing with global warming. For example, let's say a heat wave in the Twin Cities area over the past 50 years. What do you expect? What climate change is doing is we're warming that average background conditions. So what used to be a really rare event, rare heat wave, is something that is going to happen much more often. And what's the real signature of attribution is that we can have heat wave events that are unprecedented. You could not have it. And so those become lethal and dangerous. The same thing is true with extreme weather events, with the amount of rain that is falling during a storm can be quite catastrophic at times. It's those heaviest of heaviest rain events that are changing. So ironically, the attribution is much more confidence we have with the most extreme weather events, which unfortunately are making headlines.
Now, when I listen to the science of what you're saying, but I also am kind of attuned to the tone that you're using, I don't hear alarmism. I don't hear catastrophization. I'm curious about what you think about David Wallace Wells and some others who believe we've gotten complacent about climate change. Forget the people that don't believe the science, not interested in them. I'm talking about the people who they're vaguely interested in the science, but they don't feel the urgency. How do you approach this?
I have many reactions as a scientist who's been studying this for several decades. We have been talking about the changes that are coming, and we could see ahead. As scientists, we're taught to look at the data, and we know the trends. The problem was it's harder for people to really see the evidence of it. And unfortunately, we now have seen enough change that I think people, including people who are writing about this and thinking about it, like David Wallace Wells, he's looked into the data and he's frankly scared. And what happens is when you get scared, like we have as scientists, we're trying to tell the world about this issue, we're rolling up our sleeves and thinking about innovative solutions. So in fact, as we are getting more scared and people are waking up, this raises my hope because I have seen complacency, but I have also seen that Americans are starting to say, wait a minute, why should we be paying for all these disasters? Why are we bankrupting the U.S. government disaster relief program? How come people are waiting for so long for these relief money to come in? We have to do better. We have to prepare ahead of time. So that's a change. People are feeling the consequences of a 1 degree C world or 1.8 degree C Fahrenheit world. So I have more hope, although I do think if we're complacent about the solutions and rolling it out, it would not be at the scale that the science demands.
Wow. Brenda Eckwurzel is with us this morning. She's director of climate science for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. As you know, we discuss climate change frequently on this program. We also have the Climate Cast from NPR News. But we're interested in whether the messaging, the understanding, the urgency of what's happening with a warming world is reaching average Americans. And I've been recently reading about writers and scientists who are saying what we're doing is not enough to get the message out, and it is really time to be alarmist. Wanted to know what Brenda thought of that, and I'm curious about what you think about it. Do you have questions about the pace of warming, this 1.5 and 2 degrees that we're talking about this morning? Do you have questions about the way we ought to be talking about this? What do you think of that idea of alarmism? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Brenda, is it fair to say that alarmism bumps up against what happened with the politicization of climate science? I'm not saying by scientists themselves. I'm saying that's what happened in our political arena. And that is why alarmism meets this barrier of people seeing this as political.
Exactly. There's going to be a range of reactions. We already have, looking at communications studies of people in the United States, we have a category of folks who are extremely alarmed, and they're losing hope, right? And because there is action. Then we have a lot of people who are really, really trying to go about all the different concerns. There are so many concerns in life, and this one seems lower priority because it seems further off. Mm-hmm. And so that's important because we do need these type of I think, these essays and op-eds, Time to Panic by David Wallace Wells, to for people who may not be paying attention, they might pay attention to this. At the same time, I don't want those who are so alarmed already, who have looked at the data, to be losing hope, because if you go too far in alarm, then you tend to shut down and lead to inaction. So that you're right. You're right on the pulse there of the tension between alarm and let's roll up our sleeves and really share some more of those stories of momentum that's building in the United States. I was one of the co-authors of the Fourth National Climate Assessment in our chapter about reducing risk through emissions mitigation. We found that every single state in the U.S. has already been implementing a range and portfolio of policies to do their part to stay in the Paris Agreement in over 455 cities. And so that tells me that people in the United States have woken up trying to figure out solutions locally. And if at the national level we had more assistance in that and more transparency about what's going on, I think that can only accelerate the unleashing of human ingenuity that is in the United States and indeed around the world.
Mallory says on Twitter, it's also paralyzing. Environmentalists have said that little things normal people can do won't make any difference at this point, so only huge changes made through our lawmakers can even have a chance, and with this administration, there's no hope of change. I want to recommend two things to Mallory. Good Climate Cast this morning on Morning Edition about what companies like 3M are doing, and Dan Charles' story this morning on NPR about food production and this idea that if we projected into 2050 and we made some changes, it could make a difference in that timeline. Brenda, what else would you say to Mallory, who kind of says it's the big changes and that's not happening, so I give up?
Sure. Well, if everyone in the U.S. were to reduce their own emissions by 20% in ways that they can, that's easy for them, because the low-hanging fruit are surprisingly out there for you, that does add up. That could turn off many, say, coal-fired power plants, and we could, you know, just the energy efficiency, like really do not use anything other than LEDs in your home right now. It's worse to have anything less than that, and just replace it. It's a straightforward thing to do. But that has to scale up. And sharing stories about how electrification of end use and efficiency of our products and the incentives that our leaders can do to help in the businesses, to help improve energy efficiency. Do we need to have clocks everywhere and every device that we buy? That's where consumer choice becomes limited. And that's where sometimes you need to have standards put into place that say, hey, remember, everything you do affects climate, affects people, sea level rise affects heat waves around the world. We're approaching lethal levels where we may lose the coral reefs if we don't stop now. Let's pay attention and step up. And the good news is people are really looking at ways to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere using ways we already know with forests and agricultural sector and our mangroves and blue, so wetlands and things like that to help with coastal resiliency. So many of the solutions to offset, for example, we may need to fly planes and use a liquid fuel, and we may have to offset that by sucking carbon dioxide out of something that's a heavy industry, for example, like a steel industry or some other heavy industry where you want to suck out the potential fossil fuel emissions right at the source and stop it from getting into the atmosphere. Lots of solutions out there. It's just a matter of the political and the social license to keep harming the planet.
You know, Brenda, we're getting a lot of really good calls here, and I've realized that I have not allotted enough time for this conversation, which was an error going into it. So for our callers who are calling in with excellent questions, we will reschedule a show, or we'll put a new show on the books here to talk about this in a larger sense. Brenda, I hope you'll come back for that. Could you do that?
Absolutely. There's some really exciting innovations out there that are worth sharing. It's going to be a new world that a lot of us are going to like.
Good. We'll talk about urgency. We'll talk about the innovation and the imagination being brought to approaching the global warming conundrum. Brenda, I'll talk with you again soon. And thank you so much for this. Good to have you here.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.